I do want to encourage you this morning to open your Bibles to the book of Matthew chapter 23. As you're turning to Matthew chapter 23, I want to welcome you to one of the most scathing passages in all of the Bible. And yet it is a sermon of Jesus Christ. In Matthew chapter 23, we find ourselves in the Passion Week. We find ourselves in the last days of the life of Jesus. He is but just literally a few hours from offering His life on the cross, shedding His blood for the forgiveness of sins and the salvation of any and all who would receive and believe. And yet it is in this 23rd chapter of Matthew that Jesus has some very stark and striking words to communicate to a very select group of people. The first few verses that we're going to read are addressed to a multitude. It's addressed to a crowd. And the reason that it's addressed to them is Jesus recognized something that every one of us struggle with. We struggle with the fact of not being who we want to be, and there's always somebody else we wish we were. And in those days, there was a group of people known as the Pharisees. Now, that's a terminology. If you've spent any time in church, you typically hear in a very negative fashion. And we're going to see today there is a very negative light put upon this group of individuals. However, understand the Pharisees are a group of people who everybody wanted to be like. They had the best jobs, the best incomes. They had power in the government. They had power in the church. These were the guys who everybody wanted to live in their neighborhood, and everybody wanted their kids to date and marry their kids. These were the people that set the agenda for life. Now, why is that important for us to hear? Because I think every one of us looks somewhere else for guidance to what life should look like. And the word that Jesus uses so often in this passage is a word that gets such negative publicity, and rightfully so. It is the word hypocrite. You know, a term or the word hypocrite literally means one whose actions do not match their words. If we were to go back several centuries to the acting community, to the dramatic world, a hypocrite took place when they were doing a theater production and they did not have enough actors or actresses to play the parts in the play. One human being would play multiple parts, and they would either hold a sign or a mask in front of their face saying that when I read these lines, I'm playing this character. Now, the reason this is so important is that the people that everybody looked up to in Jesus's day had the same problem that most people today have. They're hypocrites. Their life in one location does not match their life in another location. What they speak does not match how they live. And in Matthew chapter 23, I'm going to read 33 verses of Scripture. And if you're a first-time guest or visitor, I don't normally read a passage this long, but this is one of those passages where it's truly hard to believe that Jesus, the same Jesus who walked on water, the same Jesus who healed people, both blind and crippled, would speak words this stark and striking. In Matthew chapter 23, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Then spoke Jesus to the multitude and to His disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore, whatsoever they bid you to observe, that observe and do, but do not after their works, for they say and do not. For they bind heavy burdens and grieves to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. All their works they do to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries. They enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the uppermost rooms at the feast and the chief seats at the synagogues, and greetings in the markets, and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. Be you not called Rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and you are brethren. And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your Father which is in heaven. Neither be called masters, for one is your master, even Christ. But he that is greatest among you shall be your servant. And whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased. And he that shall be humble himself shall be exalted." Now I want to take a small little break there, because these 12 verses, Jesus is saying to the multitudes and to His disciples, we've got a struggle here. The struggle is those who are exemplifying life, those who we like our life to look like, they're not doing as they're saying or saying as they're doing. Beginning in verse 13, Jesus then turns to the Pharisees. Jesus then turns to these people who are the elite, the religious ones, the ones everybody wanted to be. And He opens His mouth and communicates like you may have never heard Jesus talk before. Verse 13, "But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer you them that are going in. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You devour widows' houses, and for a pretense you make long prayer. Therefore, you shall receive the greater damnation. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourself. Woe unto you, blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing. But whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor. You fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifieth the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing. But whosoever sweareth by the gift that's upon it, he is guilty. You fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifieth the gift? Whosoever therefore shall swear by the altar, sweareth by it and by all things thereon. And whosoever shall swear by the temple, sweareth by it and by him that dwelleth therein. And he that shall swear by heaven, sweareth by the throne of God and by him that sitteth thereon. Verse 23, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You pay tithe and mint, anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you have done, and not to leave the other undone. You blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you make clean the outside of the cup of the platter, but within are full of extortion and excess. You blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and uncleanliness. Even so, you outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Because you build the tombs of the prophets, and you garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. You say, if it had been in the days of our fathers, we would have not been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore, you are witnesses unto yourselves. You are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill ye up the measure of your fathers. Verse 33, you serpents, you generation of vipers, how can you escape the damnation of hell? So much for sweet little Jesus. Here comes Jesus Christ days before his crucifixion, before his resurrection, with such scathing words. And he communicates about being a Pharisee. He communicates about being a hypocrite. And what Jesus is showing us today is that every one of us, sometimes intentionally, sometimes ignorantly, fall into the trap of living life of contradiction rather than a life of consistency. And so what I want to address today, if we were to take all these verses and begin to go by verse and phrase by phrase, it would take a great deal of time to unpack what did Jesus mean by the temple and the gift and the altars and all these things that at times are so foreign to us. So what I want to do today is I want to break it down real simple. I want to break it down in real easy, almost simply applicable a process of how do we understand what Jesus was saying so we don't fall into the same trap that these guys did. And I want to talk about being a Pharisee. I want to talk about how we fall into the trap of saying one thing and doing another, or living a life of contradiction. And there's really two ways that this can happen. You can either become a Pharisee intentionally or in ignorance. Now, let me unpack those for you. When I say an intentional Pharisee, I don't think that anybody listening to my voice, I don't think any one of you woke up this morning and said, I want to be a religious hypocrite. I don't think anybody woke up and said, my goal in life is to say one thing but to do another. When I say an intentional Pharisee, what I mean is that you have intentionally set up your life with certain boundaries and borders so that you believe that you can check off the box and everything's okay. It's not intentional in the motive as it is in the desire to think that your life is satisfactory and pleasurable and pleasing to God. Now, how do we do this? How do we become an intentional Pharisee? Well, the first way is simply this. We create a life that's designed around specific locations or specific geographical places. In other words, we see a church setting or we see this room drastically different than we would see the school we attend or the workplace that we go to or even our house or a place somewhere else on the other side of the world. And what happens is we fall into this trap when we say things like this. Well, I would say that story or I would tell you that joke, but I'm not going to do it here at church. Well, if you shouldn't tell it at church, don't tell it at work. And if you shouldn't say that word here, don't say it there. And the problem is that we think that our life at a certain geographical location can look differently than at another geographical location, and somehow that's okay with God. Let me give you a very graphic illustration of how Tracy and I saw this in our life. We were newlyweds. And as newlyweds, there's several things that you possess. One is you have very limited friends because most of your friends are still single right when you get married. And you also don't have much money. Well, it was a Sunday night. We had some friends that were part of a small church, and they had invited us to come to their worship service. And we went because we knew most of the people there and had known them for years. And it was one of those nights that was just pleasant all the way around. I mean, you get there and they're glad to see you. They already knew us by name. They greeted us with a smile. It was one of those things, you know, you always like to be in an environment where everybody kind of knows you and appreciates you. And it was just a wonderful experience. As we were leaving the worship service, we were invited by several of the couples to go out to eat. Now, understand, this is a traumatic event in the life of a newlywed. Why? Because we had not budgeted for the meal that they were inviting us to. And there was no indication that they were going to be paying for it. We were going Dutch. So Tracy and I discussed it real quickly, decided, you know what? It'll be good fellowship. We need some new friends. This will be great. Let's go have dinner with them. I want to share with you that that was one of the most revolting nights of our life. These individuals that just smiled and hugged us in the name of Jesus were despicable and demanding to the people who were employed by the restaurant. When they greeted us with open arms and were so flexible, hey, just sit where you want. It doesn't matter. Nobody cares. At the restaurant, nothing was on time. Nothing was right. And they made it a very vocal scene. We have rarely been more embarrassed in our life. And when the end of the meal came and they skimped out on the tip, I wanted to crawl under the table. And you wonder why an unbelieving world finds Christianity so unbelieving. When we hug people at church and we're rude to them at a restaurant. When we talk about being generous here and we're cheap out there. And when we allow ourselves to create an environment where we will excuse behavior in one location but not in another, we have intentionally become Pharisees. Because we say it's okay, according to Matthew 23, temple behavior, home behavior. So sometimes it's a specific location or geography. At other times, it becomes a specific day of the week. And I know that you've probably done some study, or maybe you have an idea. You know, we worship on Sunday. This is the day that the Christian community for several thousand years have said, this is the day that we join together, we celebrate, and we worship. But you understand, sometimes we've got an opinion of Sunday that is very contrary to Monday through Saturday. And maybe you've never struggled with this, but I've had people come to me before and mention something like this. Pastor, what do you think about somebody who mows their yard on Sunday? You know what my response is? How tall is the grass? I don't know. And you think about it, because they struggle with the fact that, you know, it's the Sabbath. Forget the fact that in Exodus 31:13 and Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 12, it says that the Sabbath day was a sign between Israel and God. Now, let me give you a little asterisk here. I do believe we need a day of rest. I do believe that we need to pause and focus on the things of God. I get that. But do you realize if you advocate, you know, it's Sunday, you shouldn't do any work on Sunday, then guys, you're going to have to stop watching football because they are working on Sunday. You're going to have to quit eating out on Sunday because when you go to a restaurant, they are working on Sunday. And God forbid that on this day of the week, if you go home and your heart rate goes up and you begin to feel pressure in your chest, don't call 911 because those are employees of a medical facility who will come and visit you. You see how we can live such a contradictory life? That I'm righteous because on a certain day of the week, I don't participate in certain behaviors, but I expect everybody else to participate so that I am facilitated. And I don't think you mean harm. I think you're desiring the right thing, just like these guys, but it ends up materializing the wrong way. And so sometimes it's the environment or the location. Sometimes it's the day of the week. But sometimes it is the style or approach that we have when we worship God. Now, let me be very pointed with you for a moment, because I know this is our second service. I know that when you look at the worship God, we call this the contemporary service. And oftentimes we can get caught up and prideful about that, because if we hear a choir special or if we hear a song that is old, it makes us cringe. And we say, man, why can't the church just be contemporary? You do realize those old hymns at one point were contemporary. And the songs that you sing today that are new one day will be old. And the problem is that we begin to put God in a box and say, well, God can't be honored in that style. God cannot be honored in that way. Let me give you a hint. Do you realize that most people on planet Earth today who are worshiping Jesus Christ are not even doing it in English? So according to that methodology, we're struggling because most people are doing it in other languages. I'm going to give you an example of a friend of mine. He was at a Bible conference one day. He's a pastor like myself. And he was at this Bible conference and he was teaching and they were talking about worship. And it was in John 4:24. God is a spirit and those that worship him must do so in spirit and in truth. At the end of his Bible conference, there was a man who came up to him very upset, very frustrated. And some of you will like this, particularly in this service, because this man was just, I mean, he was spitting venom that he did not believe that you could worship God with all that contemporary loud music. He was just upset about it. He was bothered. He thought you ought to worship a certain way at a certain time in a certain place. To which my very wise, astute friend said, sir, can we continue this conversation out in your pickup truck? He said, sure. So they went out to the pickup truck. He said, sir, would you mind turning the ignition on? So he did. He said, sir, would you mind if I mess with the radio controls? He said, sure, go ahead. And you know those preset buttons that are on the radio? He began to push every single button. You know what he found? There wasn't a single station preset to gospel music. It was classic rock and country western. Story took place in Texas, okay? Now, understand, we can fall into the same trap even if we're on the opposite end of the spectrum saying we need to be new, we need to be relevant, but we need to be contemporary. But when we say, but God can only be worshipped in this manner, in this way, in this location, then we have some serious issues we've got to deal with. That's how we become an intentional Pharisee. We mean the best. We're desiring to worship God. But the problem is it manifests itself in a very contradictory life. And to be honest with you, I'd be willing to say most of you, hearing me in this service, most of you are probably not intentional Pharisees. Most of you probably aren't geared that way. What happens is, most of you have probably become what I want to call an ignorant Pharisee. Now, I'm not saying you are ignorant. Ignorance means literally that you fall into a situation or you step into it not meaning to. So when I use this term ignorant Pharisee, you never meant to become a Pharisee. You never meant a life of contradiction. It just somehow accidentally occurred in your life. In fact, you might want to say it better, an accidental Pharisee. What are the ways that that can happen in our life based on Matthew 23? Here's the first one. You get caught up in the trap of compartmentalizing your life. Now, we know what a compartment is, right? It's a small subset of something bigger. Probably one of the greatest examples of compartments are what we know as the famed cruise ship, the Titanic. You remember that famed cruise ship, the one that supposedly would never sink. And the way that that ship was constructed, there were compartments after compartments that if they struck an iceberg or if they ran aground, that a certain amount of compartments could fill with water, and as long as it blocked off the other compartments, they would be okay. Let me tell you how we compartmentalize our life. We say, well, that's how I behave at work. This is how I behave at home. This is how I behave at church. This is how I behave on the ball field. This is how I behave with them, and this is how I behave with those people. We compartmentalize our life, and what happens is we end up adapting our life to the culture around us rather than transforming the culture. Let me give you a couple examples. Guys, I'm going to pick on you. Then girls, I'm going to pick on you. And it can go both ways. This is not a gender exclusive illustration, but I think it suits the purpose. Guys, there can come a time in your life where you're at the workplace, you're at the gym, you're at a ball field, you're out with a restaurant, a bunch of guys. And for some reason whatsoever, there is a young lady who's in your presence that the flirtation begins. And you don't mean it with harm. You mean it harmlessly. And you begin to banter back and forth and make little innuendos toward her and her toward you. You realize that if you would not say those things with your wife eating dinner with you, you're compartmentalizing. Because you're saying it's okay to act that way toward someone who's not my wife if my wife's not there. But if she were there, well, I would never say those things. Hey, ladies, and by the way, this is not gender exclusive. If you'll say something on Facebook that you won't say to their face, that's compartmentalizing. Because you're saying in this environment, it's okay, but I would never do it face to face. That's what we call talking behind somebody's back. Don't talk behind their back, something you wouldn't talk to their face. So compartmentalizing our life is when we live a contradictory life, or we would do things in one environment that we would never do in another environment. That's compartmentalizing. The second thing we tend to do, or we accidentally fall into the trap of, is what I call categorizing. We categorize our life by who we are or what we do. Let me give you some examples. If I were to list for you the categories of my life, I am a husband. I'm a dad. I'm a child. I'm an employer. I'm a resident of a specific county. I live in a specific neighborhood. There are so many different categories that I can categorize my life by. But first and foremost, the category that should be the key is that I am a saved, born-again believer in Jesus Christ. That category, the fact that I realize that I'm a sinner in need of saving, that categorization ought to trump all other categories. Now, I know you may be thinking to yourself, well, time out. This whole marriage thing that we're supposed to make work, aren't we supposed to put our spouse first? Yes, but under Jesus. See, Jesus said in Matthew 6:33, seek you first the kingdom of God, and all these things, all means all, will be added unto thee. And what happens is when we begin to miscategorize our life, we fall into a horrible trap. I want to share with you a story that happened over 20 years ago, but it's still so fresh in my mind. I grew up as a young child in church. I was not blessed to have an Awana program like we have here where, you know, the students get together and they do the Bible verses and they come together and they play and have all kinds of fun. I grew up, and some of you may not be familiar with what I'm going to talk about, but I got a couple of good amens in the first service. I grew up a royal ambassador. Hey, I got some royal ambassadors. Okay, on the other side, got any girls in action here? There we go, got a few. If you're going, what on earth is that? Years ago, and I'm dating myself, and it's still in existence today, there was a discipleship ministry in churches, royal ambassadors for the guys, girls in action for the girls, and royal ambassadors was kind of a Boy Scouts with the Bible, so to speak. And what it really did, it made church so much fun. Because, you know, you tie knots, you go on camping trips, do sports, but yet at the same time, I was a lad, 1, 2, 3, page squire knight. I went through all 6 years. And you know what made my RA experience, royal ambassador experience, so much fun? Honestly, it was the leaders that I had. I thought these guys were so cool, but I thought they were so old. The funny thing is they're my age now. But looking back at the time, I thought, man, these guys are like ancient, but they're my age. That's why they were so much fun, to be honest with you. That being said, they made church so much fun and so enjoyable. When I was in high school, I'd gotten out of the RA program. I'd grown up to become a part of the student ministry. Growing up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, you know, there's times where you don't have a lot of money and you want to have a good time. And so the guys go out, and one of the things that we found a good, cheap form of entertainment, we went to Dallas Maverick games because they stunk back then. And they couldn't give tickets away. You'd go in by the cheapest ticket they had, get in the nosebleed section. By halftime, you were sitting in first-class seats because nobody else was there. And we had gone to a Mavericks game one night, and during the, you know, when they changed quarters, we'd gone out into the big hallways, and we were looking for some food. And there in the distance, about 40, 50 feet away, I saw a group of guys. These were my RA leaders from when I was a kid. Just a few years back, they were at the Maverick game. I'm thinking to myself, how cool. These guys come to Maverick games. You know, these are awesome guys. When we got closer, about 10 or 12 feet away, the look of intrigue in their eyes turned into absolute horror. For when our eyes met the chest, every one of those guys had a big old 32-ounce beer in their hand. And I got a question for you. You think any of those guys would ever take that to RAs? Never. But you know what happened is they started categorizing that being out with the guys trumps being an RA leader. Or hanging out at a ball game trumps what I do with those guys every week as I pour my life into theirs. And what happens is we don't mean to. We don't mean to categorize, but we don't realize what can happen when we start saying, well, that's this life and that is my other. But last but not least, the way we kind of fall into Phariseeism is we customize our life. You know, we live in a world today of custom everything. You can customize your car. You can customize your house. I want you to know, I thank the Lord for custom clothes. You ought to see how much fabric they've got to cut off the bottom of my pants when I go buy a pair. It's incredible. I can you know, take care and build shorts for people. I mean, custom stuff is good, all right? The problem is when we apply customization to Christianity, what we say is, I have my version of Christianity, you have your version.
I say everything's okay but this, you say everything's okay but that. And what ends up happening is we have our flavor, you have your flavor, and pretty soon there's no consistency whatsoever, because not only is our life different in one location than the next, but none of our lives are consistent when compared to each other. And that is why an unbelieving world so easily defines Christianity so unbelievable. So we conclude with this. As Jesus shared this message in Matthew 23, what can we do? How can we change our lives? How do we respond to the fact that every one of us at some level, in some way, whether intentionally or not, finds ourselves drifting into a life that's contradictory? The first instruction or the first piece of advice I want to give you is this. Is have your life be Christ-like. What that means is categorizing your life that as a born-again believer in Jesus Christ, wherever you are, whoever you're with, your relationship to Jesus is more important than your relationship to anybody or anything else. If that is your desire and that is your goal, it will literally solve 95% of all the pharisaical issues in your life. Number one, Christ-likeness. Number two, consistent living. That means that whatever you do in here on Sunday, you ought to do on Monday and vice versa. If you're in church, if you're on the ball field, if you're at school, if you're at home, our life ought to imitate or look the same everywhere we go. You know what the world is craving right now? Authenticity. The world is craving for people who go to church on Sunday to act the same when they show up to school on Monday or go to work. The world is craving an authenticity. It's craving a consistency. And for those of you who don't know me well, I know I'm a little bit goofy up here on the platform. Trust me, I'm just as goofy off the platform. I am who I am. But whether you like it or not, this is who I am. And the world is craving an authentic, consistent life. But here's the last thing. This sums it all up. Not only should we be Christ-like, not only should we live consistent, but we ought to live a life that has a great concern for others. Meaning that how we live on Monday, what we say on Monday, what we do with social media, what we don't, that we actually care how others see, perceive, and respond. And I want to give you some of the wisdom of the ages. Please understand, the illustration that I'm about to use involves a specific behavior. But don't limit it to this behavior. I'm going to unpack it for a moment. This advice, this wisdom of the ages, comes from my own mom. This was something she shared with me as a young child and grew up in my teenage years. And now as an adult, I realize the wisdom of what she said. Now, some of you are going to get upset with what she said, but just hold on and let me unpack it. Here's what she said. She said, Jeff, you know, drinking a beer is not going to send you to hell, but it might help send somebody else. Going to that location and participating in that activity may not send you to hell, but it may help send somebody else. Saying what you said to somebody the way you said it may not send you to hell, but it might help send somebody else. And what she was communicating to me in a very clear way that Jesus was trying to communicate when he said, you realize your proselytes are twice the children of hell as you are, is that you personally, you might have come to a point in your life where you've admitted you were a sinner and asked Jesus to save you, but we live in a lost and dying world that is craving to see Jesus in you. And our behavior and our mannerisms and our words, if they will reflect out there what we claim to believe in here, it will be like a light to a bug. It will be absolutely irresistible. You know, just this weekend, my kids and I watched a great modern day, as far as I'm concerned, classic, Wreck-It Ralph. Y'all watch Wreck-It Ralph yet? Hey, if you're a child of the 80s, it's your movie. I mean, it's all about 80s video games. It is good stuff. In Wreck-It Ralph, and I don't want to spoil the conclusion, but I'm about to. So if you've never seen it, you don't want to be spoiled, cover your ears right now. The enemy in the movie, who is a bug, is eliminated when the protagonist, when Ralph, creates a light so bright he cannot resist it. And if our lives at home and at school and at work and even, yes, here on this campus are so bright for Jesus Christ, then the world will not be able to resist it. What they resist is when we live our life here one way and there somewhere else.